Hello and welcome to this episode of the Cyclo Edition, the podcast for those looking to go above and beyond in their understanding of the synthetic organic literature. I'm Matt Genzink, and I'm joined today by Grace Lutowski and Wesley Swords. The paper we're discussing today is titled Light-Driven Deracemization Enabled by Excited State Electron Transfer, and comes from the Knowles Group at Princeton and the Miller Group at Yale. The Miller Group specifically seeks to develop new reactions to enable the synthesis of complex molecules, while the Knowles Group focuses on exploring the synthetic applications of proton-coupled electron transfer. The paper we're covering today specifically highlights one example of this work where the authors report a visible light-driven deracemization of cyclic ureas. So this paper describes a method to prepare enantio-enriched compounds using a deracemization strategy. Deracemizations are just one of several ways to synthesize chiral compounds. And before jumping into deracemization specifically, we wanted to review some of these more general strategies. So arguably, the most utilized strategy is an enantioselective reaction, which put simply is a reaction where two different enantiomers can be formed and one of those enantiomers is favored.
Yeah, and in that style of a reaction, you may either start with two achiral materials or you can start with one that's chiral and one that's not and form products that are enantiopure. The difficulty with enantioselective reactions comes when you want to, say, take material that's a racemate, so you have both enantiomers present already, and you either want to do a reaction that favors only one of those enantiomers going forward, or you want to just purify that material to one of its two enantiomers. And so some of the reactions that exist, and we'll go through each of them in a little bit more detail, are kinetic resolution, in which you take those two enantiomers and you basically just favor one of them through some sort of reaction. Dynamic kinetic transformations, in which you take a racemate and you just react solely to one enantiopure product, or what we'll talk mostly about today, which is deracemization, where you take a racemic starting material pool and just deracemize it to a single enantiomer of that same starting material.
Yeah, so we talked about kinetic resolution a couple of podcasts back in more detail when we were going through the synthesis of procyanol by the Riesman group. And basically it's when, like Wes said, you have a mixture of two enantiomers and you use a chiral catalyst that reacts faster with one enantiomer than the other. So in a kinetic resolution, one enantiomer is selectively removed from another. So theoretically, the highest possible yield is 50% because one enantiomer can be converted completely to product and then the other enantiomer is unreacted and remains as the starting material.
And this differs from dynamic kinetic transformations, where they start with a racemic mixture of your starting material, but then they go through some sort of intermediate to where both enantiomers react and are converted to an enantiomerically pure product. This is a transformation, so if you wanted just an enantiopure starting material, you would then have to react back to that molecule.
And so the final example is deracemization, which we're going to talk about for the most part today. And that's where you're just starting with a racemic pool of some material, and then you're going to enantio-enrich that same material through some sort of reaction. And so the difficulties that come along with trying to do a deracemization reaction is the fact that it's both thermodynamically unfavorable, as well as it basically goes against the principles of microscopic reversibility. Thermodynamically, a deracemization is entropically unfavorable. Basically, you're building order into your system by favoring a single enantiomer over the racemic sample. Knowles, in his paper, mentions this. The effect is small. This entropic term is small, but it's an uphill by about 0.42 kcals per mole at room temperature. And so somehow you have to supply this additional energy to your system to allow it to get over this barrier, and then you need to have a significantly high enough barrier to the racemization event to prevent the racemization of your material once you've deracemized it.
So this is something that I personally hadn't really thought of before. And because you learn that enantiomers are at the same energy, and so their enthalpic value is the same, but this difference in energy comes from their entropic value, like what Wes said, going from two enantiomers to this single enantiomer. The system is becoming more ordered, and that is where your overall energy of the system is uphill.
Yeah, and to build on what you were saying, Wes, you mentioned that to do one of these derasmizations, you need an external driving force to make it favorable overall. And kind of a corollary of this is that no derasmization is totally catalytic. You need some sort of stoichiometric reagent to make the reaction favorable. So to go back to what you were saying earlier about microscopic reversibility, and if you're not familiar with microscopic reversibility, it's the idea that in a reversible reaction, the mechanism in one direction is exactly the reverse of the mechanism in the other direction. So basically how it applies to a derasmization is any process that can convert an S enantiomer to an R enantiomer can naturally go the other way and can convert an R enantiomer to an S enantiomer.
And because those two enantiomers have the same fundamental energy, the barrier to that process is the same in both directions. And therefore, you need some sort of external driving force, like Matt was saying, to actually drive that reaction to favor one of those enantiomers.
There are sort of two ways that people have gotten around this principle of microscopic reversibility. In terms of thermal reactions, you can get around this where your mechanism for destroying your stereochemistry and your mechanism for recreating the stereochemistry proceed by distinct mechanisms. And photochemically, which we'll get into a bit from now, doesn't by nature adhere to the principle of microscopic reversibility. So just kind of by nature, it circumvents the problem of microscopic reversibility.
So I think the best way to describe how a thermodynamic chemical-driven deracemization reaction works is to look at basically the first chemical deracemization, which was done by Dean Toast. And this was an article published in JAX in 2013. So the Toast group was looking to deracemize indolins through using an oxidation and a reduction reaction to basically oxidize the indolin to the imine form, which would then ablate any sort of stereochemistry at the alpha carbon, and then selectively reduce the imine back to the indolin in an enantioselective event. So the way that they thought about doing this was basically phase separating the reductant and the oxidant. And so as Matt had said, you need to basically have your oxidation reaction and your reduction reaction occur through two different distinct mechanistic events. Because if they occur over the same mechanism, then you basically fall into the fate of microscopic reversibility again. And so by having those events phase separate, where one may occur in the solid phase, the other may occur in an aqueous phase, and the majority of your material pool sits in an organic phase, you're able to distinguish these reactions.
And that also overcomes another challenge that in these reactions, you have an oxidant and a reductant, and they are going to react with each other faster than they're going to react with your substrate. And so by doing the phase separation, like Toss demonstrates, he was able to minimize that background reactivity.
And to reference back to what we were saying before, the stoichiometric reagent that's causing this whole reaction cycle to be favorable are those two stoichiometric reductants and stoichiometric oxidants.
So Toss used phase separation to ensure that his oxidant and reductant did not react with each other. This strategy of using an oxidation reaction and then a reduction reaction have been used more commonly. And Zhao published a JAX paper in 2015 that showed an oxidation and reduction to do a deracemization reaction, but used chemically compatible oxidants and reductants. And so those both underwent different mechanisms, but did not react with each other and allowed a deracemization reaction to occur.
I think what this precedent and others that we're not necessarily going to get into show is that this redox thermal approach is potentially very general, as long as the oxidant and reductant are chemically compatible.
One of the interesting aspects of deracemization chemistry in general is the fact that it kind of falls out of older literature using enzymatic chemistry to drive deracemizations, namely focused around the deracemization of unnatural amino acids. So attempts to make biologically relevant unnatural amino acids, finding ways to make them enantiomer-enriched through deracemization was of high interest. And so there's a really good coordination chemistry review that came out in 2008 that kind of describes the whole history of this. But basically the way that it worked was you would have an oxidase and a reductase that would drive a very similar style of reaction to what Toast and Zhao have done chemically, in which you would initially either oxidize or reduce selectively in an enantiomer of your natural amino acid. And then once you've ablated some of that stereochemistry, you would then do the reverse reaction using a different enzyme. And therefore, you'd have two distinct mechanistic events. And either both could be enantioselective or only one of them was enantioselectively, but you basically drive that forward. And this idea of deracemization can kind of be generalized. And Zhao, I think, does this really well in their paper by saying that a deracemization reaction comprises two half reactions that are opposite in reaction direction and have completely distinct mechanistic pathways. At least one of them needs to be an enantioselective. And so in Toast and in Zhao's case, the reduction reaction ends up being their enantioselective reaction. And as we get further into discussing some of the photochemical reactions, it becomes kind of interesting when you think about what happens when both of those reactions are enantioselective and how the enantioselectivity of one of those reactions can propagate through with the next one.
So thinking about some of the thermal reactions that we've talked about before, specifically, let's take, for example, the Toast reaction. In that reaction, like Wes was saying, you start with a racemic mixture. You do an oxidation to form an achiral imine, and then an enantioselective reduction to reform an enantiopure, an enantioenriched material. And the idea with a photochemical deracemization is not that different. You start with a racemic material, and then you go through some excited state that is achiral, and you go back down to the ground state to make an enantioenriched material.
That is actually a point that we want to kind of make, is the fact that when we're talking about these photochemical reactions, and we're talking about excited states, we're actually talking about a photoexcited complex, right? It's absorbed a photon and has reached an electronically excited state. Sometimes when you read the lit on some of these either deracemizations or just some of like the dynamic kinetic resolutions, they'll mention the ATP transferase reactions in biology or things like that, and talk about when you do these chemical or enzymatically generated deracemization events or chemical fuel events, that you insert energy into the system and you form these sorts of excited states. And they're really not photochemical excited states, they're just like a more highly energetic state due to either an oxidation or reduction reaction. In these cases, the Knowles and the Bach papers, we're actually talking about a photochemically excited molecule, basically.
Yeah, the paper we've been alluding to is the Thorsten Bach paper, which was published last year in Nature, and was the first example of a highly enantioselective photochemical deracemization. And in this case, the example or type of substrate that they choose to demonstrate this strategy on is an alline, which works because alines in their ground state have axial chirality, but the alline triplet state is planar, meaning that it's an achiral triplet state.
So since this paper by Bach is basically one of the most recent and one of the best examples of deracemization catalyzed by visible light, we want to go into it in a bit more depth. And so I'm just going to start by describing kind of the generic reaction that Bach is using, and then we can describe kind of how he's able to get a deracemization event to occur. So the reaction that Bach is looking at is the deracemization of alenes that come off of a lactam ring. And so these alenes are inherently chiral, as Matt said. They have axial chirality. When you have four distinct substituents on the 1 and 3 carbons. And so what Bach initially does is he takes a thioxanthone catalyst that, when excited, is quickly forms a triplet state. This triplet excited catalyst can undergo a triplet energy transfer with the alene to form the alene triplet. These alene triplets are planar and achiral in their excited state, in this triplet excited state. And therefore, then when they decay, they can decay with a 50% probability of forming either their R or their S enantiomer. And so what Bach shows initially is he takes his parent substrate and he synthesizes it in enantiomerically pure, and then shows that with the thioxanthone, he shows that he can racemize that alene. And so that the chance basically to go the opposite direction is there. If he can now maybe put that alene into an asymmetric environment, he'll be able to optically enhance his starting material.
So these catalysts bind to the substrate with different binding affinities. So it will bind to one enantiomer more than the other enantiomer. And so the substrate that it binds to more will undergo a faster sensitization because it is more closely bound, which then will undergo the, like Wes and Matt were saying, the planar transition state. And when that is in a chiral environment, that will rotate the substituents to form the enantiomer that was less tightly bound. So that will build up the other enantiomer in solution.
To summarize, basically what's going on is the allene that favors binding to the catalyst is sensitized faster than the allene that is being built up in solution. And so through the favored thermodynamic and favored kinetic sensitization of the allene that binds stronger, you get selective depopulation of this allene and selective population or growth in population of the opposite. And so that's how Bach is able to drive photochemically this deracemization reaction. What was interesting is it was kind of counterintuitive when I first read this paper, and it still kind of is counterintuitive when I try and draw the reaction. I typically draw the allene that favors binding as the one I would think would be the one that would be built up, because you're having a preferential, you know, interaction with the catalyst. But because that one ends up being selectively sensitized, it's similar to the idea of a kinetic resolution, where the you have some chiral thing in solution, in this case your photocatalyst, that is doing a selective reaction on the enantiomer it favors. And so in this case, we're favoring one enantiomer, and the favoring basically the switching of that enantiomer to the opposite due to the steric interactions with the catalyst.
And another thing to note here is that enantiomeric excess in a reaction like this is built up over time. Wes and Grace mentioned that one enantiomer binds more favorably to the chiral photosensitizer than the other. And over time of that enantiomer going through the triplet state and then decaying back to the ground state, you'll get an increase in EE until you hit what's known as the photostationary point, where the EE doesn't change anymore as a function of time. And that's when the deracemization is at its highest theoretical EE, I guess you could say.
A photostationary state is basically an equilibrium that's reached under light. And so you hit a point at which the sensitization of both species becomes equal. And that's just because you have such a higher population of one of your enantiomers than the other, they are now able to be sensitized at equal rates. And so that decay then ends up, you know, just giving you back the exact same population every time you sensitize a new substrate. Just one more comment to make before we move on. Bach has now basically been able to show that this works on other substrates as well. He did a dipymethane reaction. And again, this one, in terms of the allene paper, like he really, like they went after this and like, you know, hypothesized they could do it and got this. The dipymethane was more serendipitous. And it kind of aligns more with the Knowles case, where they were trying to do an enantioselective dipymethane reaction and just noticed that over time after that reaction was done, they actually built up more, or a higher enantiomeric excess, and found out that what they were doing was a racemic dipymethane reaction followed by an enantiomeric or a deracemization event of that dipymethane rearrangement. And so I think that aligns a little bit more with the Knowles paper, and as we get into that, where the Knowles group was just really able to identify a very small enantiomeric buildup over time in a reaction, and they were able to then follow that to its end for this paper.
So like Wes mentioned, Knowles and his research group kind of discovered this through a reaction that they were studying, which was a hydroamination reaction. And what they found was after 4 hours of running this reaction, they saw a 50-50 enantiomeric ratio. But after 16 hours, they saw a 53-47 enantiomeric ratio, so a 6% EE. And that happened as they let the reaction sit for a longer time, so 4 hours versus 16 hours. So they alluded to that this must be forming the product, and then a deracemization reaction is occurring after. And so they kind of then went and studied this further by looking at the product that they formed and introducing the same reaction conditions. So starting with that product, a racemic mixture of that product, and introducing the same reaction conditions, and seeing that then they saw a 60-40 enantiomeric ratio towards the S enantiomer. They also started with the S enantiomer, so started with greater than 99:1 ER, and using a non-chiral phosphoric acid, they saw the racemic mixture of that product. So the chiral phosphoric acid was inducing some sort of enantioselectivity on this deracemization reaction.
They basically go on to postulate a mechanism for how they think this photochemical deracemization is occurring and how they'll go about optimizing, or how they basically went about optimizing this reaction. So they start with their cyclic urea starting material. And this urea has a stereocenter alpha to one of the nitrogens of that urea in the cyclic urea molecule. And so what they postulate is that they're going to excite an iridium-based photocatalyst to its excited state. And then that iridium photocatalyst is going to oxidize the cyclic urea to the nitrogen radical cation. And that then basically gives them their reduced photocatalyst, which could then re-reduce the oxidized amine. And that happens basically for the enantiomer that is the less reactive with the chiral phosphoric base. So once they get to that radical cation of the cyclic urea, the phosphoric base comes in and deprotonates at that alpha stereocenter, leading them to form a carbon-centered radical. Well, in this carbon-centered radical, you've ablated the stereochemistry, and therefore you can then do a hydrogen atom transfer from their thiol in solution, which they postulate this could be done enantioselectively, but may not need to be done enantioselectively, to return your starting material in an enantium-enriched environment. And basically what they postulate is that one of the enantiomers will react faster with their chiral phosphoric base, leading to that ablated carbon-centered radical. And because, say, the R enantiomer will react faster, the S enantiomer, which will react slower, will undergo back electron transfer with their photocatalyst and will not react in that reaction. And so basically what you'll build up is you'll build up the S enantiomer in the reaction, while the R enantiomer will be used up and converted to that S enantiomer.
So relating this back to previous methods, this takes advantage of both some of the thermal strategies that we talked about before with the TOAST and the Zhao paper and other enzyme papers like Wes was talking about, and the photochemical method that Bach uses. It's similar to the thermal method in that they are using an oxidation reduction strategy to do this deracemization. This is a bit unique because both the oxidation and the reduction can be made enantioselective, which we'll get into in a little bit. But it also takes advantage of a photochemical deracemization in that there are no stoichiometric byproducts other than light. So while the thermal deracemizations had a stoichiometric oxidant and a stoichiometric reductant, the chiral controllers in this case are totally catalytic. The only stoichiometric reagent in this reaction is light.
So the optimization of this reaction was actually quite neat. To start, they optimized the chiral phosphoric base. So this is just a vinyl-derived phosphoric base where they saw that the extended conjugation helped the EE. But for this, they were only able to ever get up to an 86-14 ER. And so they thought that they could also employ the chiral thiol to help this enantioselectivity. So for that, they looked at cysteine-based or peptide-based catalysts. And so these have been shown to be hydrogen atom transfer catalysts, but haven't been utilized as frequently in asymmetric catalysis with small molecules. Looking at various derivatives of these, so they were able to optimize this catalyst to a 79-21 ER, and this optimization was done with an achiral base, and then the phosphoric base was done with an achiral thiol. And so both of those reactions showed the enantioselectivity of the individual steps, to where when they put them together, then they thought the enantioselectivity should be the multiplication of these two EEs, and they were able to see that was true. So if you're looking at the paper, entry 14 is where they combine the two chiral catalysts to see that they got a 93-7 ER, which actually surprised them in a sense, because they were expecting, based off this multiplication, for it to be 96-4. But then they thought about that, and they thought this thiol radical that is formed in the reaction may be reacting to racemize the product by abstracting a hydrogen. And so if they added some source of a weak hydrogen that it could abstract instead, they thought they would get the selectivity that they predicted. So they added triphenylmethane to the solution in 50 mole percent in entry 15, and they saw the selectivity that they predicted, which was 96:4 ER.
This idea of the multiplicative, it really surprised me that it gave you the exact multiplication of those two things. But if you think about the theory, basically these are two entwined steps, but they're basically two steps that occur one after the other. There is no equilibrium that is being formed in these steps. They occur and they occur. They're just sequential. And so in theory, the ER that carries from one doesn't affect the next step. That next step is going to have the same ratio no matter what ratio that the step before it gives it. And so when you think about it that way, theoretically, like, it has to be this multiplication of those enantiomeric ratios. And so that was really surprising on the initial read of this paper. And I think it's really, really cool. And they discuss this later on, and we'll get to that in a second. But it just really, you know, kind of shocked me and made me really appreciate kind of the work that was done in this paper to show that, and the fact that they were able to identify two different ways. I also wanted to mention that, you know, Knowles is not the only primary author on this paper. Scott Miller also is a corresponding author, and his group is really specialized in these polypeptide cysteine reagents. And so that's where his group was able to really come in and help the Knowles group overcome the barrier to get to these highly enantioselective reactions. And so it really shows that the collaborative work of these two groups that allowed this, you know, real cool fundamental understanding to be developed.
Near the end of the paper, there's a nice diagram of the energetics of light-driven deracemization that really explains the origin of the stereoselectivity. So basically, just as a summary of what we've been saying before, the photocatalyst, the iridium-3 photocatalyst, is excited. After intersystem crossing goes to the triplet state, and this becomes an oxidant capable of oxidizing both the R and S enantiomers of the starting material at the same rate. It's at the same rate because the photocatalyst is achiral. So you get a 50-50 mixture of the radical cation of the starting material, and this is where the first enantioselective step takes place. That radical cation has two possible fates. It can either undergo a proton transfer, or it can undergo back electron transfer to reform the starting material. So in this case, because the base is chiral, the proton transfer is faster to the S enantiomer than to the R enantiomer. So the S enantiomer will react faster and in a higher proportion. The R enantiomer, in contrast, will go back to the starting material. So basically, you are, in this step, enriching the R enantiomer. After the S radical cation reacts, it forms an achiral alpha amino radical. This alpha amino radical then can react with the chiral thiol. And in this case, the barrier for the formation of the R enantiomer is lower than the barrier of the S. So the R is formed in a higher proportion. So both of these steps contribute to enrichment of the R enantiomer.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is the first step, and this kind of gets back to the quote that I read from the Zhao paper originally, where you have two half reactions that lead through two distinct mechanisms to give you the enriched material. The first step, which is the electron transfer to the excited state followed by proton transfer to the base, is a sequential proton coupled electron transfer reaction that's basically just separated spatially, where you react with the iridium, then you react with your chiral base. The second step after you get, so that's one enantioselective pathway, that's stereoablative. So you want to ablate the stereochemistry of the enantiomer that you want to depopulate, the enantiomer that you don't want. The next step, which is now a hydrogen atom transfer, which is a concerted proton-coupled electron transfer reaction, is reforming your material. It's reforming, and so you want to form now the enantiomer that you want to enrich. And so you want that reaction to occur basically with the opposite enantiomer, or form the opposite enantiomer of what you were just ablating in that precept. So you have two distinct mechanisms, two distinct half reactions that occur during different, you know, through different mechanisms. And in this case, one is a sequential electron transfer followed by proton transfer. The other one is a hydrogen atom transfer, which is a concerted proton coupled electron transfer reaction. And so this is, I think, basically one of like the coolest examples of how you can, you know, take that idea and actually do a very highly selective deracemization reaction.
One of the cool general strategies that I took from this paper and that Wes was talking about before is just that this idea that you could have two, really in this case, moderately stereoselective reactions, and in tandem, because of this multiplicative effect, it can result in a highly enantioselective, in this case, reaction.
Yeah, and they show that really well in one of their tables. They basically take all of their substrates or a lot of their substrates and show what the experimental EE is when they have the proton transfer, when they have the HAT, and like they only have the chiral base, or they only have the chiral thiol, and then they have for a predicted EE and or an ER, and then an experimental ER. And in almost every case, barring a few, they're within 2% EE. The only one that actually falls off of that trend is when they actually use the opposite enantiomer. So they use like a mismatch where they have the opposite enantiomer of what you would want for your hydrogen atom transfer reaction. And that gives you more of a racemic reaction than you would expect. But because you're coming from like an ablated stereocenter, I think that kind of makes a little bit of sense. The one thought that I had from this, and one of the like I think broad ideas of this reaction or of this methodology in general, is electron transfer reactions are much more, are just more broad than triplet energy transfer reactions are right now. And you can map electron like photocatalytic electron transfer reactions onto reactions that haven't been done before or have only been done chemically. Because all you're doing is changing a chemical oxidant or a chemical reductant for a photocatalyst. You know, there's optimization there, but like you can see it a lot easier, I think, than like trying to find how to triplet sensitize, you know, a substrate that has never been triplet sensitized before. So this reaction has a bit more, I think, like broad applicability, or at least right now a broader sense of applicability than say Bach initial transformation. While Bach initial transformation, however, was just fundamentally insightful and amazing in its own right. What I really want to know with this reaction kind of comes out of Bach, which is what if we were to use a chiral photosensitizer? So we know that there are chiral latiridium photosensitizers. We happen to use them in the Yun group, but they've also been used by others, as well as organic photosensitizers. That, you know, does that also play a role? If we make that initial electron transfer step, as well as the proton transfer and antiselective, would those also be multiplicative, or would that, because now you have the back electron transfer that may also then depend on this chirality of the photocatalyst, would that maybe mess with it? Would it enhance, but not so much? Like, does that multiplication follow through back all the way to that initial electron transfer? And so I think there's a lot more insight that can be developed here by physical organic chemists into like how these reactions work and exactly where, you know, what each part of this reaction plays a role in. And, you know, can we get away from proton coupled electron transfer reactions into other styles of reactions as well?
And that's our show. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Cyclo Edition. For more information on the papers discussed, we have included a selection of the resources we used in our research at the end of the YouTube video. This was our take on a very interesting paper, and we would love to continue the conversation with you. Please comment below the YouTube video and reach out on social media. You can follow the Cyclo Edition on Twitter, where we will post updates about our next episode. You can find the Cyclo Edition wherever you listen to podcasts and on YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe. We will provide the paper we will be discussing during the next episode in the description of this podcast, as well as on social media a few days before the next episode is released.